Good afternoon, everyone. Good to see everybody here today. Some smiling faces in the crowd. Everybody can smile, right? Lots more smiling faces in the crowd. It's great to be here. Glad it's a Sabbath. Boy, it was a rough week. Anybody else have a rough week? Anybody else have a rough week? Yeah. It's a rough week. This was my month-end close week at work, and I told several before services, if I could just survive till Thursday night, it would be a good week, to survive. So we survived Thursday. Yesterday was reasonably peaceful at work because we were off-site. We were out at Titan Stadium doing some training. That was pretty cool. Got to get my picture taken with two Titans cheerleaders, and Sherry did not like that at all. I liked it, though. I thought that was cool. They smiled and everything. I got to be right in the middle. I'll have to bring that picture someday. Put it up on the wall. Well, I struggled this week a little bit with what to speak about. I had a couple of topics going on, and one of them was about afflictions. We all have afflictions. And I came up with these 12 terrible afflictions and how they're all beneficial to us in the end. And I thought, it's a cold, rainy week. It's windy outside. It should be snowing, but it's not. And nobody wants to hear about afflictions. After all, we just came off a feast. We're all still very high. We're looking forward to a Passover here in a few, several short weeks probably. So I thought, I'd been working on a couple different topics, and maybe it was Thursday morning, and it finally became very clear to me what it was to speak about today. And it was something that came to me, and I know that it was probably because Tim Duncan was praying about this. He said he was praying for the delivery and preparation. Well, Thursday morning at about 4:30 or so, it became very clear what my topic was going to be, and it was going to be laced with a little bit of humor. Humor is always good, right? We should enjoy that on the Sabbath. But we're gonna cover an interesting topic today in a little bit different kind of way. And what else would you expect after having Chuck Smith up here the week before? So try to do something on equal par. But in addition to all that, I heard sort of a funny story this week that kind of reminds me of my son-in-law. Or maybe one or two son-in-laws possibly coming up, and maybe some of you younger or middle-aged fathers will also understand this or appreciate this as your daughter's age. As it turns out, there was a fellow and a daughter, and the daughter brought the fellow home to meet the parents. This was after they had become engaged. Right, that's when you want to meet the fellow. Well, the daddy coaxed the boy into visiting him in his woodshed. And he asked the boy a few questions. It was one of those cold nights. It was a little bit rainy outside. There were leaves all over the driveway. Leaves got tracked into the shed. There was a fire in the wood stove. There were a couple of guns on the bench being cleaned for deer season. And there was an axe in the corner for kindling by the wood pile. It smelled like smoke in this place of questioning that was to occur. First question the very mean daddy asked, "Well, now you see how my daughter's been raised. You see how she's become accustomed to living. You see where she lives. You've seen her room. You see the fine dining room where she dines. How, pray tell, will you provide that? After all, what are you, 19? 20, perhaps?" And so the boy said, "Sir, I've become a Bible scholar, and I firmly believe that God will provide." To which the stern father in the woodshed said, "I see. Well, you've seen how well my daughter likes to eat. What with only the choicest cuts of meat from Harris Teeter, the nicest foods available, not on the sale aisle. Around here, we don't do Kroger, we don't do Walmart. We go to Save a Lot." No, we don't go to Save a Lot. Save a Lot. Sherry goes to Save a Lot. So you know this isn't me talking. "How will you provide for that fine palate?" The boy said, "Sir, as I mentioned earlier, I've become a Bible scholar, and my new faith has taught me no matter what, God will provide." "Ah, yes, I've learned that too, my son, in my long, hard, difficult, painful years. But let me ask you this. Let's just say a young one comes along. A little one comes into your family, perhaps sooner than you expect. Maybe that happens to you. You know, diapers aren't cheap. And you can't just use paper towels. You have to use those wipes. They're all expensive. Last I heard, a diaper service costs up to $200 per month. What then, son?" Then the boy said, "Sir, I perceive you to be a prophet," or something like that. "And you seem to know all things, and you tell me the answer. But I stand behind my consistent response that God will provide." After that, the daddy and the boy walked that long path from the shed to the house. The old wise man's wife cornered him in the back bedroom, away from everyone else, and curiously she said, "Well, how does he shake out? How does he shake out? I mean, you were out there for quite a long time." He said, "Well, there's bad news and there's good news here. I'll give you the bad news first. The boy has no job and no prospects to speak of whatsoever. But the good news is he thinks I am God." Has anybody ever heard that before? Everybody, I bet, right? It was the first time I heard it this week, and so I had to embellish it a little bit, add some details. Well, wasn't it nice? I think everybody will agree it was nice to see Chuck and Mary here last week. Wasn't that wonderful to see them here? And Chuck coming up and giving a classic Chuck Smith type sermon. I'll never forget when I met Chuck and Mary. Sherry and I had been married maybe a year. Didn't have kids yet. And Sherry and I were living in close to Murfreesboro, but we were going to church in Nashville, and we decided, well, we're going to go to church in Murfreesboro today. See about that. It was probably about 1990 or 1991 or so, and they had morning services, and Chuck Smith had just begun giving sermonettes in Murfreesboro. And he got up and gave a sermonette that I can't remember the topic. All I know is he was on fire for his topic, he had everybody's attention. It's almost as if everyone adored Chuck. And I didn't even know Chuck. I just thought, he sure does have a pretty wife. Hey, I was 22 years old. Anyway, I think she's still a beautiful woman. But after he was done with his sermonette and he came down, and it's almost like he had to take a breath to come back to his seat. And I turned to Sherry and I said, "Who was that red-faced man?" But that was sort of the beginning. That was the beginning. And boy, we struck up a friendship shortly after that. And Chuck has challenged me a lot over the years. In fact, I had no building experience whatsoever, and I had a house that had an expansion space above the main space in the house. And so I framed it out and learned how to frame, learned how to hang sheetrock, learned that I didn't ever want to hang sheetrock again because that is a mess. Learned that that's the kind of thing that you hire out. You know, other people are a lot smarter than I am when it comes to that sort of thing. But he also taught me, he came over and taught me how to run some basic electric wiring and things like that. And you know, back then, I mean, we're talking 1990, 91, 92. I was in the church. I'd been to Ambassador College. I went to church. I opened my Bible basically once a week when we're at church. But I wasn't in my Bible all the time. But Chuck Smith was, and we would be working on something and sweating through something, and he would just like pepper me with questions. Question, question, question. "What do you make of this, Mike? What do you make of that? What are you reading? What are you studying?" And after a while, I was like, "Do I really want to invite you over to help me work more in my house? Because, man, you're just giving me a headache. You know, I can't stick with you." But you know what? He just smiled. He just smiled and kept it up and kept it up and kept it up. And I just grew to really love that about Chuck Smith. And we spent so many times, Mary would come on over to our house, and we'd stay up until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and talking about the kingdom, talking about the Bible. But man, he challenged me. And he got a great idea. He thought, I think the men in Murfreesboro, and several of you all were probably involved with this, if I recall. He got the men in Murfreesboro getting Bible studies together. You know, we didn't have Bible studies every week, every 2 weeks, even once a month. But Chuck thought it'd be a great idea for all of us guys to start getting prepared to give Bible studies. So he called me up on Sunday morning. I was minding my own business as usual out in Christiana, reading the Sunday paper, drinking coffee and enjoying my wife, getting ready to cut the grass. Didn't care about football in those days at all. Those days are back, pretty much. I didn't care about those kinds of things. And the phone rang. And Chuck Smith called me and he said, Mike, I got a question for you. I'm just wondering if you're man enough. So, of course I'm man enough. I mean, there's no debating that. What are you talking about here anyway? He goes, I need to know if you're man enough to present the book of Revelation on Wednesday. I think I might have been about, this must have been around 96 or 97. I said, after I coughed and pulled myself up off the floor, I said, well, of course I'm man enough to present Revelation on Wednesday at 7 o'clock after work. And so I did nothing else for probably how many hours except 10 between then and Wednesday at 7 o'clock getting ready for Revelation. And I thought, I'm going to cover all 22 chapters of Revelation in an hour. I think what we did is we had an hour or 50 minutes or an hour, and then we had a break. We'd have cheese and crackers and sparkling cider and things like that. And then we would come on back and finish it up in like 30 or 40 minutes, if I recall correctly. So it was nice. We had Bible studies about every 2 weeks in Murfreesboro. That was really a wonderful time. So I got there all full of myself, ready to present Revelation. Did my studies, did my research, knew all the answers, and basically told everybody there that if you don't understand this, why, you just don't understand. Whew. Boy, was I wrong. So we got through, Revelation 3 in the first hour or so, and then we took a little break, and then we went through Revelation about 6, I think it was, and that was it. I couldn't get through Revelation 22 in this little two and a half hour Bible study. And Mr. Keller's is in the audience that night, and you know, I had just barely begun doing any kind of speaking, and to see the pastor of the church at your little Bible study out in the country in Murfreesboro, was like, oh. And he got up and gave some comments after. He's very kind, very nice, just like Mr. Keller's always is. And he said, you know, we look through a glass darkly, and this is a very hard to understand book. And you know, we don't understand everything about Revelation. And I just stood back there and took my lumps and said, thank you, Lord, for being so patient with me while I learn, you know, take my lumps, really. But it was an interesting time, very interesting time in Murfreesboro back in those days. We had probably 25 or 30 people coming to church regularly, and there was probably 23 or 25 coming to those Bible studies every couple weeks. About the same time, Chuck got a great idea to present all of the minor prophets. You know, we do that, you know, one every couple weeks, and I think he put them all in a hat, and we all pulled them out, and I pulled out mine. I think I had Habakkuk. But the one I remember the most is Jonah. I got to present Jonah. I thought, oh, that'll be easy. So I didn't know anything about Jonah other than what we all knew about Jonah. You know, the fish, and Jonah got eaten by a fish, or did he? And then he had to go do something he didn't want to do. And so I spent a lot of time getting ready for Jonah, probably maybe a month or so, learning about Jonah. But I love that book. It's one of my favorite books in the Bible. And I think it's because I studied it so long and so hard, because I didn't want to be caught not knowing or not understanding. I don't care now. Now that I've been doing this a few years, I don't care if someone says, oh, you were wrong on that. Sometimes people come after service and say, you know, you were really wrong on that verse. I'm like, oh, let's talk about this. Not having a nice little interaction. I've been wrong. No problem. If I'm wrong today, I hope you come see me after services. Because I may be wrong on some of these things. But, oh, I love Jonah. When someone goes to Jonah in a sermonette, a sermon, or a Bible study, you got my attention because I love that book. I love the book of Ecclesiastes for the same reason. My dad told me, you better read Ecclesiastes. Usually when I did something wrong, it was Proverbs or Ecclesiastes. He goes, you better get in your room. I want 10 chapters of Proverbs, and I want you to come talk to me about them. That was sort of my punishment. Well, little did he know that really wasn't that much of a punishment, because I would get into my word and really learn a lot. And those are wonderful wisdom books. But I love the book of Jonah. And I want to cover Jonah today. I want to cover a little bit of Jonah today. You know, we all have a story. We all have a story really about how God mercifully, very mercifully called us out of this world. And part of the sermon today, as you've heard already, is hearing a little bit about my story. I'd like to encourage all of us to meditate on our own stories. What is our story? And when did God get our attention? Why did he get our attention when he did? Mine started very early, 8, 9 years old. I've told lots of people this. Being involved in the church and getting to know God has been the most promising, most consistent thing that's happened to me in my entire life. It's something that, it's like clockwork. You know, we go to Sabbath services. Every Sabbath we have the holy days. And now I've been in the church for 35 or 36 years, something like maybe 37 years. You know, Sherry and I keep a list of our feasts. I think it's been 37 now. But it's been the most consistent thing in my life, the most encouraging thing to my life. And you know what? It's even more encouraging now. I mean, every week it gets even more encouraging, knowing God's truth, knowing the truth that's in the Bible, the encouragement that's there. But I think God does this to us, and he gives us these great stories that we'll be able to tell at services. Maybe partly how we keep the Sabbath holy is telling people stories about how we survived the week, about how we came into God's truth. Maybe we'll be sharing those stories now. Maybe we'll be sharing them very soon in the millennium. Hope so. Surely we'll be sharing those stories for a long time in the kingdom. And he's given us all just a treasure trove of great stories. Very shortly after Chuck started to nail me between the eyes, I don't know why, but I think it must have been about 1998, 1999, round about then, 2000, I developed an almost urgent curiosity about the Bible. You know, I'd been to Ambassador College, went to the theology classes, studied business, but at the same time, I had to take speech and principles of living and the life and teachings, and I didn't get to take some of the other ones that theology majors were taking, but I got a pretty good taste of it, and I went through the motions and memorized. In fact, I found a list of memory scriptures not long ago in one of my trunks, and I don't know why in the world we memorized those scriptures, because I don't even barely recognize them now. They weren't like the fruit of the Spirit. You know, we weren't memorizing that sort of thing. We were memorizing things back then that I would be hard-pressed to point to in the Bible right now. And as such, I got terrible grades in my theology classes because I just didn't have that good of a instant recall memory of what verse was where. But maybe it wasn't my time at that point in time. But one of these Sabbaths in Murfreesboro after services, Sherry and I found ourselves in the Salt and Pepper Christian bookstore over there close to where we're meeting for services. And I saw a set of cassettes. I was going to bring it in here and show it to you today, but it looks like a little briefcase of tape cassettes. Now, does anybody listen to tape cassettes anymore? Michael? You probably do. I can't find a tape cassette player in my house that works anymore, probably because it just hasn't been worked. And I have a feeling that rubber band that drives it is broken. I can't find one. My truck is so old that it has a cassette player in it, and Mariah uses my truck to go back and forth to work. So I thought, I'll just rewind all these and give them to Mariah because she wants to listen to this in the truck. Well, I wore that thing out. I bought that, and it cost $125 at the time. I mean, $125 for a Bible? That's a lot of money to spend. But I thought, I don't know why, but I've got to have that thing. And in my car, I had a CD player, but it didn't have a cassette deck. So what I did was I rigged up something with a little jam box next to the seat with me in the car, and I had an adapter that plugged on into the cigarette lighter that I never used, of course. You know, back then, there were cigarette lighters actually lit cigarettes back then, I think. I don't know if there is that in the cars anymore. Are there? I mean, I know they recharge phones and things like that, but I don't know if there's such a thing as a cigarette lighter in a car anymore. So I rigged this up, and I had my normal old jam box that you would plug into a house line, plugged into an adapter, into the cigarette lighter, and I would listen to those tapes. And it would take me 6 weeks to get through the whole Bible on my route back and forth to work. But I loved that. I loved it. And I had a little hand recorder that when something came up, some verse came up, and I got curious about it, like the Urim and the Thummim. What in the world is that? Well, I would say, what is the Urim and the Thummim? And then I would research that. What about casting lots? What's that all about? How do you do that? How do you cast lots? Why don't we cast lots now? Was that acceptable in Israel at the time? Well, so I would record that in my little recorder and then research that stuff later and use that for food, for sermonettes and Bible studies and things like that later. But I probably listened to that thing 6 or 8 times, and then another version would come out, like one I'm going to play for you here in a few minutes. And I hope you'll bear with me, but I just wanted to give you a taste of this. But you know, that tape cassette version, I listened to 8 times. I lent it to other people. They listened to it. And then Jerry Steyer wanted it. So he got it, and it stayed at his house for probably 8 years or so. And finally, just now came back to my house. But, you know, of course, they're not rewound or anything like that. So I need to find a cassette player that'll rewind tapes. Anyhow, so that thing has gotten lots of people's money's worth, that's for sure. But ever since then, when a new dramatized version of the Bible comes out, I listen about it, I hear about it, research it, and find it. And I usually get one. And here's an excerpt. We're going to talk a little bit about Jonah today, but I want you to hear this. And so that the proper credit is given where credit's due, I don't want to get in trouble. This is from the Word of Promise, dramatized New King James Version, Thomas Nelson Publishers, 2009. And we're just going to play this. It takes 12 or 13 minutes, and then we've got enough time for that today. So I hope you enjoy this. I love this. This is the kind of thing that that I like to listen to in the car on the way back and forth to work. So I hope you enjoyed that. It's kind of like going to the movies. That's how I look at it, sort of. But, you know, when you're in the car for a long time, what are you going to listen to? Sports radio? You know? What are you going to listen to? 107.9? Or 107.5, or kinds of things like that that'll set your day right. Of course, you know, that only took 13 minutes to get through all of Jonah. And you know what? It's way, way too fast. So there's so much to cover there. But if you're in the car for an hour or 2 hours a day, you know, that just stokes you for, you know, something later, you know, that you can study into it a little bit later. But I'd like to hit just a few high points. In conclusion, Jonah's name means dove, and I think that's kind of interesting. Jonah was written during a time of peace, extended peace, and relative prosperity, the northern 10 tribes of Israel, during Jeroboam II's reign. Spiritually, those tribes of Israel were in a time of spiritual poverty, ritualistic religion, increasing levels of idolatry, and perverted justice. That's when Jonah lived. Peacetime and wealth, which we've really experienced quite a bit of here in the last long time in the United States of America, made Israel bankrupt spiritually, morally, and ethically. And here we've got a story of a prophet being sent to a pagan nation. And that doesn't happen often. In fact, that's probably the only instance where a prophet was sent by God to a pagan nation, told him to repent. Nineveh The name Nineveh actually sort of means home of Nimrod. And we know the stories about Nimrod. So this is the kind of city that God is saying for Jonah to go to. It was roughly 500 miles from Israel. So it was no easy trip to get to Nineveh. And who knows, Jonah may have thought, that's a long trip. That's a wicked nation. I'm not going to go there. I don't want to go there. I don't want anything good to happen to Nineveh, is what Jonah was thinking at the time. The people in Nineveh worshipped Ishtar, and they worshipped other names of other gods that I won't mention. But those gods looked like half man and half fish, which is kind of interesting when you consider that God used a fish to ultimately bring Jonah to the shores of Nineveh. The mariners, here we read in verse 5, then the mariners, which that name really sort of means salty. And these were rough, tough men in that ship. These weren't easygoing kind of people. These were hard mariners. It says, the mariners were afraid, and every man cried out to his God, and threw the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten the load. But Jonah had gone into the lowest parts of the ship and lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came to him and said, what do you mean, sleeper? So they knew. They knew what the reason for that rough sea was. And in verse 7 it says, come, let us cast lots. You know, an interesting thing to do to determine what the will of God was. And it was an acceptable thing in Israel to cast lots. And God made his will known during casting of lots. And they cast lots, and the lot, the blame, the fault for all of this tempestuous sea fell straight on Jonah. And in verse 8, they said to him, please tell us for whose cause this trouble is upon us. What's your occupation? Where do you come from? What's your country? And of what people are you? So he said to them, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, and made the sea and the dry land. So it's very clear to these salty, rough-cut, hard sea-going mariners that God is God, and not their little g gods. I want to go to verse 15. So they picked up Jonah and threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. What do you think of first there? You know, Jesus Christ said, peace be still, in Mark 4:39. And the seas were still. And that's somebody that I want on my side every day at work. Somebody I want on my side every day with interactions with my family. I want that person on my side that says to the sea, peace be still. And the confidence that comes with that. Verse 17, now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. Something that Jesus Christ referred to, you know, toward the end of his death. So Jonah has some really important words here. Chapter 2, verse 1, you know, isn't this the truth? Everyone here understands this. Then Jonah prayed. He prayed. He was in the belly of the fish, and it took him getting into the belly of the fish. Maybe it takes us getting into a rough situation at work. You know, maybe it takes getting into a very difficult conflict and affliction with somebody in our family. Maybe that's what it takes. Maybe it takes to the point where you just say to God, I don't know what else to do. I don't know what else to do. I can't do anything else. Show me what to do next. Verse 2, I cried out to the Lord because of my affliction. Affliction, interesting studies all through the Bible on affliction. And afflictions often are blessings in disguise. Blessings in disguise. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried. Imagine Jonah in the belly of this great fish. I mean, how much air is there? What does he see floating by in that belly? What does it smell like in there? What does it feel like in there? Probably feels bad being in the belly of this big fish. Probably didn't have much air. Probably just enough air to kind of stay alive. That word Sheol literally means a catastrophic condition near death. I think some people here in this room have experienced a catastrophic condition near death. We've experienced that. Verse 3, "For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the floods surrounded me. All your billows and your waves passed over me. Then I said, I have been cast out of your sight, yet I will look again toward your holy temple." Jonah was feeling alone. Alone. He was feeling away. He was feeling apart. And he wanted to be back. "The waters surrounded me, even to my soul. The deep closed around me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. I went down to the moorings of the mountains. The earth with its bars closed behind me forever. Yet you have brought me up. You have brought up my life from the pit. O Lord my God, when my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer went up to you, into your holy temple." It's just as applicable now as it was back then, isn't it? I hear people say sometimes, oh, that book, that's so ancient, it's not applicable today. But you know what? This book is just as applicable today as it ever has been. Verse 8, "Those who regard worthless idols forsake their own mercy. But I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay what I have vowed. Salvation is of the Lord." So the Lord spoke to the fish. So Jonah came to a conclusion. During his prayer, the Lord spoke to the fish and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. And, you know, we were talking about acid from the fish's stomach. And it's commonly believed that acid from the fish's stomach would have bleached Jonah's face. And how interesting that is, that here is a people that's getting ready to be preached to who worships a fish god. And here's this fish that's brought Jonah to preach to them. It's really a picture of God's greatness is what it is, because God tells a fish story about a fish worshiping people and uses a lukewarm, who cares kind of attituded prophet to cause thousands and thousands of people to repent. Isn't that a wonderful story? I mean, I just think it's awesome. And so the story goes on, and Nineveh, that horrid, you know, city, which is Assyria, Chuck Smith has given sermon after sermon about the hideous things that the Assyrians did of torturing people during war. Awful. And yet God said, those people, I'd like to have a chance. I'd like for them to have a chance. And Jonah, you're the man. Chapter 4 is also very interesting. It says, "But it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he became angry." And it also says in the Bible that the anger of man is not pleasing to God. It's not a pleasing thing. I know when I get angry, there's nothing pleasing about it. There's nothing right about it. It's usually pretty sinful. But listen to Jonah's anger. "So he prayed to the Lord and said, Ah, Lord, was not this what I said when I was still in my country? Therefore I fled to Tarshish, for I knew that you were a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm." Now, what if you're walking through the woods and you happen to see this burning bush and God speaks to you and says, go to Baltimore and preach to the people in Baltimore, the home of the Ravens. Tell them their sin. I mean, would you have an argument with God? I mean, Moses argued with God. Jonah argued with God. And I have a feeling that we probably have our own special ways of arguing with God. But this is how Jonah did it. Verse 3, "Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life for me, for it's better for me to die than to live." And this is like the ultimate father example. It hits me between the eyes. Listen to God's response to Jonah. All he says is it right for you to be angry? So Jonah went out of the city, sat on the east side of the city. Therefore he made himself a shelter and sat under it in the shade, till he might see what would become of the city. And the Lord God prepared a plant and made it come up over Jonah.
that it might be a shade for his head to deliver him from his misery. So Jonah was very grateful for the plant. So God there is doing good. He's only going to be doing good and showing patience. But as the morning dawned the next day, God prepared a worm, and it so damaged the plant that it withered. And it happened when the sun arose that God prepared a vehement east wind, and the sun beat on Jonah's head so that he grew faint. Then he wished death for himself. So he goes from angry to happy to angry to wanting to die, to happy to angry to wanting to die. Then he wished for death for himself and said, "It's better for me to die than to live." Then God said to Jonah, again, very patient, very kind, very nice, warm, fatherly, Is it right for you to be angry about the plant?" And he said, "It's right for me to be angry, even to death." But the Lord said, "You have had pity on the plant for which you have not labored, nor made it grow, which came up in a night and perished in a night. And should I not pity Nineveh, that great city in which more than 120,000 persons who cannot discern their right hand and their left, and much livestock?" So he cares about people who are sinners, and he also cares about cattle. I don't know if I would have cared about Jonah had Chuck not challenged me to present that minor prophet some years ago. But you know, I do love Jonah. I'm very grateful to him for introducing me to that. I guess it's been about 3 years now, and when I found out that Chuck and Mary are going to be moving to Florida, I did something that I don't do very often, but I cried. You know, something I've not done much in my life. But I knew that it was for the best. It was for the best of the church. I knew that a whole new group of people all over Florida and the Caribbean were going to get Chuck Smith. I knew it was for the best. I told Chuck Smith in that same woodshed, the one right next with the wood stove, with the axe in the corner, with the guns that were being cleaned, I told him that our friendship set me on the right path. And I had tears in my eyes. But always the encourager, Chuck Smith, without even batting an eyelash, said, "You were already on the right path." Well, I know that God puts people in our lives for big reasons. And my love of his word has only been stoked over the years by long conversations with Chuck Smith out in the woods, on the roads around his house, on the roads around my house, along with spilt blood, sweat, and tears over the years at such things like Camp Tomahawk and now in the Caribbean. So may all of us be blessed with strong bonds with God's people who help us become closer to the great God who we all know in the end is the one who wins.